And good morning once again, or good evening, or whatever time it is, wherever you are on this vast and rotating globe orbiting a star called the Sun. Well, this morning we're going to do a little change-up. I'm doing something I've never done before. I'm going to explore the background of the entire Montauk mystery. I have a film director and film maker with us this morning, Christopher Garitano, and we're going to get to him shortly. But before we did that, I thought I might do something a little different. This came across my desk this afternoon, and it was so intriguing, and I thought, well, it's radio. We've got to do this. There's an astronomer in Turkey who has taken astronomical readings, electronic readings, of a particular star, an oscillating star, and he has literally transcribed this into standard musical format, and he has put it on the web. So what I thought I would do is to play you a few bars after I kind of describe what he did, because this is part and parcel not only of what this show is about, which is interesting audiophile experiences, but it's also a kind of an interesting backstory to the physics that we've been looking at. As you know, there is a very long life in the scientific world to people looking at the possibility of influences or overtones or harmonics or the music of the spheres, as Kepler termed it. It turns out that this guy has actually done it. His name is Burak Ulus, and with the Izmir Turk College Planetarium, he has taken his work into a musical dimension using star oscillations as a source for a musical composition. He has uploaded this paper to the RXIV web server, which is where a lot of these unreviewed papers reside. It's actually just north of us here in Santa Fe. And he also, in the paper, gives a shout-out to other pioneers like Kepler and Pythagoras and even modern composers. Astronomers and other stargazers have long associated celestial bodies with music, as I said a moment ago, twinkling of some stars offering a tempting backbeat, and some stars in particular offer a variety of opportunities. One such star, YCAM-A, and the CAM stands for Camelopardalis, which is a very exotic way to say camel. YCAMELOPARDALIS A, Ulus notes, offered enough oscillation data for use in creating chords. It is actually a binary, two stars orbiting around each other, which accounts for its twinkling, that is, the visual oscillations as each star eclipses the other one. But instead of a steady on and off blinking from the eclipses, the system actually oscillates at four different frequencies. He mapped the lowest tone to note A using the free online music synthesizer called Audacity. Actually, I think Art mentioned Audacity to me the other day. Then used that as a base to map three of the star's oscillating frequencies to notes commonly used in a chord progression popular in modern music, G, C, D, and playing the notes in the manner in which they were broadcast by the star resulted in an interesting tune, as this writer says, to say the least. To jazz up the piece, quite literally, he added music he'd created before, played on a piano, based on YCAM-A's whole tones that correspond to a diminished whole tone scale, which is often used in jazz. The result is a mixed bag of eerie pulsating sounds combined with a simple piano melody. And now, if all this technology is actually working, I should be able to press this little button and you will hear literally the music of the stars.
Thank you.
Well, that's kind of intriguing. I don't think we're going to be using that for break music, but it's composed, as I read from the article, of the actual oscillation frequencies keyed to musical instruments. And if you want to read the whole story with some back links and some other stuff, I think Rich has put it up on our website tonight. If you go to othersideofmidnight.com and you click on tonight's guest, that takes you to the second page devoted to the guest. And at the very top is our Radio with Pictures graphic. And next to it are the web links. And I will go and do exactly what I have just said so I can make sure it's all there. And yes, it is. And with that, we will move into our guest of the morning. I'm going to be talking this morning with Christopher Garitano, who was born in New York. Now, it doesn't say here what part of New York, like New York City, New York State, whatever. It just says he was born in New York. So on that basis, well, let me move on. He majored in film and is a graduate of the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan. He is the owner and president of White Phosphorus Pictures. And in 2005, Chris released his first documentary titled Horror Business, an experimental study regarding the struggles of independent horror movie making. I could go on. But what I'm going to do is to go to a musical break, and then we'll bring Chris on, and we'll discuss something which, frankly, I really don't know that much about, so we'll all find out together when we talk to Chris Garitano in just a couple of minutes. Garitano is a filmmaker, and rather than describe the rest of his life and career and his interest in Montauk, why don't I bring him on? Chris, good morning.
Yes, hello, Richard.
Oh, that's good a morning. Good. That's a very good signal. Yes, you sound like you're right across the desk. How did you wind up being intrigued with film? Let's start there. How you started as a filmmaker?
Well, it was around about the end of 2005. How I started as a filmmaker. I started when I was a little kid. It was every movie from Universal horror films, Frankenstein, Dracula, Creature from the Black Lagoon later on, and then being bombarded with everything at once when I was a kid because my parents owned one of the early mom-and-pop video stores in the early 80s. So I had a voracious appetite for movies, and I watched every era of film, basically in one shot in my formative years. So, I was obsessed with science fiction and horror, that's where it all started. And I think most filmmakers, it starts when you're young, and I think for the most part, sitting ground level with action figures was really the first motion pictures I was making.
Action figures? What kind of action figures?
Oh, as a kid, everything.
Oh, G.I. Joe and all that?
Yeah, sure, because you're making your own motion picture, because you're using your imagination, but you're using these idols to move them around, and basically you're mimicking that same action later on.
This is so eerie. My filmmaker friend, my director friend in Los Angeles, Paul Davids, started, I think, probably a generation earlier than you with a 16-millimeter camera, not a video camera. And sure. He literally did the Harryhausen things with monsters. He would move the models, the wire models, a fraction of an inch, and then he'd take a frame, then he'd move them a fraction of an inch. So this took forever. But his stuff actually looks almost as good as Clash of the Titans, which is that famous Harryhausen film with all stop motion, you know, special effects.
Oh, I'm very familiar with it. Jason and the Argonauts.
So that seems to be a pattern. You film guys get into it by imitating what the other guys are doing, and then it slides into...
Sure. I mean, I was inspired by John Carpenter, you know, Steven Spielberg, of course. And then later on, I went to film school, so I got into everybody from Francis Coppola to Werner Herzog and all those guys. But really, you know, I think the people that really inspired me were the prophets of science fiction and horror, you know.
Well, we have that in common. So, all right, so you're a kid and you're playing with all this and you're using a video camera. At what point did you say, this might make a really interesting job, profession?
Well, I was first into special makeup effects. You know, like you were just discussing, a lot of people got into Ray Harryhausen and stop motion animation. I was into special makeup effects, and I learned how to make masks at a very early age. You know, I was inspired by everybody from Rick Baker to Tom Savini. And I met a special effects makeup artist at the age of 12 named Jay Wells. He was great. And
that must have been one of those pivotal meetings.
Oh, very much so. And I accompanied him to a lot of jobs. You know, it was difficult for him to find work in that time, but he's an extremely talented guy. And he was taught by Dick Smith and, you know, the great makeup artist who did The Exorcist and The Godfather. So what happened was I learned from Jay over a number of years and then later realized that, you know, I wasn't going to be able to tell a story with the makeup. I would always have to execute someone else's design for the most part. And I love special effects makeup, and I respect artists that are allowed to execute these elaborate things like Rob Bottin did in John Carpenter's The Thing.
Now, let me stop you there. As a film guy, and I want you to be very, very honest with me, there are two versions of The Thing, the Howard Hawks original, and then John Carpenter's 84, something like that?
I think it was 82 or 83.
Okay. So which one do you like better, and why?
Okay. I saw the Howard Hawks version when I was very little as well. I loved it.
Oh, my God, yes.
I think that I've learned to really appreciate Carpenter's version better just because I feel that the fabric of it is so much more intricate and different, and it's original. And, of course, those effects are just mind-blowing and terrifying. I remember I saw this as, I think, I was born in 76, so I saw the movie very young. And, I mean, seeing something like that, you know, I was never exposed to anything like that, and just being so blown away by it, as I was by, you know, The Creature from the Black Lagoon before that. But watching John Carpenter's The Thing, it just, I think even the intensity as an adult should understand, you know, the characters and the claustrophobia that they were all going through came across better for me, even though over the years I've really learned to love the Hawks version maybe just as much.
Okay. So you're into all the sci-fi and the horror, and you met this very important person. How did you wind up actually getting into film?
Well, I had to make a choice after high school. I was either going to go, and at the time, there weren't many schools. There was one in Florida called the Joe Blasco School of Special Effects Makeup. And I think I was applying for that school, and I decided last minute to work a little harder to get into the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan for film, because I just, my sensibilities were more geared towards being a director and a writer at that point. And that's where it started.
And obviously, since you've made some pretty interesting films now, it was a good choice.
I think so. I mean, I've lived it every day, and sometimes I have to remind myself this is what I've always wanted to do. And it's because it's difficult sometimes. You really have to give up a lot, you know, especially working on an independent level.
Oh, I would certainly say that. I mean, financially, uncertainties, how do you pay actors? How do you get a good script? Technologically, though, it's become so much easier for an independent filmmaker like yourself to produce a really classy product.
I agree with you. And this is, if Orson Welles was alive today, I think he would wake up a lot of young movie makers and remind them how lucky they are right now.
Incredibly.
And that probably would have killed to have been in this situation when he was making his last picture, The Other Side of the Wind, that was never finished. And this is something that he always wanted, you know, because he would carry around one of the first portable editing stations around that time. He was making F for Fake and then his last film. And he, you know, this is something that he dreamed of. I think most filmmakers in that era dreamed of this. And now it's available to us.
How, in terms of costs, have you priced out what it would take to do your movie if you used film and labs and sets and, you know, location shots and all that compared to what it took to make it by a video?
Oh, yeah. I think the picture as it is, if it was made, let's say, in 1985, would have cost at least $1 million, I think. I made it for a little over $26,000.
Oh my God, that's about what my videos cost.
Yeah, now but mind you, I sacrificed everything in my life. I did just about every major task myself, and I knew what I was doing. So I think it requires a very particular situation. That's the cost of what I spent on the production, but what I wasn't paid for in the hours, thousands of hours of work. You know, you have to consider what you're going to sacrifice for that price. And no one was really paid. A few people were for particular things, but, you know, it was a very independent production. And that's what, you know, that's the risk you're willing to take for something like this. And that's the amount of time you have to put into it.
So your first film was called Horror Business?
Correct. And that was a very carefree project. I literally was just, you know, because we went from having video cameras, independent filmmakers in the last, you know, 10 years that we were shooting on mini digital video tape. And now what we have is the closest thing to becoming once again a movie maker again, because we're using lenses and we have a super 35 millimeter sensor that mimics that 35 millimeter, celluloid. So we're shooting at 24 frames per second. It's at a very high resolution, and it really is. You know, I felt, because when I went to film school, I learned to make movies on 16 millimeter, and that's all I learned. I learned how to cut movies and shoot them on 16.
That's a skill that's not going to come back.
No, in fact, it was graduation day. I was going up to see my thesis advisor, and they were removing the upright moviolas and the Steenbecks from the editing department and replacing them with computers. So I was the last generation in that school.
Oh, my God. That must have been a trip.
Yeah, very much so. I felt a little obsolete walking out, but I'm grateful for the experience because it taught me so much about having discipline, you know, because we had fewer choices with 16 millimeter in terms of editing, at least.
So you went through school, you went through the technological transition, you've realized that you've got the world by the tail if you know how to tell the right story. What made you pick the film that you titled Horror Business as your first major film?
Well, I wrote a screenplay for a horror film at the time, and I was trying to find funding for it, and again, that was at a time where very different than now because things have changed exponentially. So the most logical project, because there was this new, at the time it was a revolutionary camera, it was the DVX-100. It was the first video camera at the time that was available for relatively cheap that would shoot a simulated 24 frames per second that would mimic motion picture film. And it was a fantastic camera at the time. And I figured, okay, I can't really afford much right now, but what's the best logical project right now? I knew a lot of independent movie makers. I was publishing a small magazine, and a lot of them, I talked to them. Some of them wrote essays. So I began to just interview them and visit them and collect a lot of footage to just capture the zeitgeist at the time of the independent horror filmmaker and see what I came up with. And, you know, it was a very carefree, very independent project. I made it almost 100% by myself.
So what happened to it?
It was completed in 2005. A lot of people saw it, including one of my childhood heroes, George Romero, director of Night of the Living Dead, loved it.
Mm. So did you show it at a film festival?
I did. I showed it at venue screenings and film festivals. It played in festivals, I think, for about 4 years. And a lot of people seemed to really enjoy it. And, having George Romero check it out and he gave me a quote for the box when it was finally picked up by Image Entertainment.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
They released it, and they picked up the U.S. license for it.
So how many copies have you sold, if I can be so crass?
You know what? I don't know how many copies they sold, but I decided the second time around, which finally completing Montauk Chronicles, that I was going to be the distributor, because I, on quarterly statements, if we're going to get into business from Image Entertainment, they sold a lot more than what I feel they should have paid me. So they made a lot more money than what my advance allowed. You know, I think they made. In total, last time I checked, they made about $60,000, and I made about $10,000.
That sounds like Hollywood.
Yeah.
So much for being an independent filmmaker, free of the studios and all that. So you've realized now, in the era of the web and the global community, that you can write, direct, produce, create, publish, post, premiere, and then distribute all in one shop, so you're really the filmmaker and the distributor.
Yes, and it's no longer a taboo. See, there was this thing that was created, I think, mainly by the industry and the lack of access to equipment. I worked for Panavision New York, which was the greatest rental house for motion pictures for quite some time. And, you know, just renting the Panaflex Gold at the, it was a very high-end camera, 35 millimeter at the time, was $1,000 a day just for the camera body, which didn't include all the accessories. So it was a monopolized business, okay? And now it's not.
Wow. So anybody can really, I mean, the reason I'm going through this is because in this audience, which consists of a lot of people, a major spread of ages, including a lot of millennials, I'm kind of trying to get them to look at this as an opportunity. Because you can give us some secrets tonight of how to take this technology, which is now kind of off the shelf, and do almost anything with it.
Oh, I really, you know what? This is such a warm welcome. I really appreciate talking about this, because most of the time, I don't mind, but I'm talking about mainly the investigation end of things. And this is a motion picture, and I work, I'm a filmmaker, so I love talking about the process.
Well, without the filmmaker, there is no film. So.
Correct. Well, I've been in a few paranormal type film festivals, and I think they forgot what a motion picture is because my film has style to it. I was accepted to these festivals, but they're not going to give me the award because it's too stylized, and they're looking for the talking heads, and they're looking for the very blandness of a lot of these documentaries that are almost identical to each other. And I try to do something different. You can tell a story, and you can reveal an investigation with images. You know, that's what motion picture filmmaking is.
So you approach the production of this film called Horror Business from a very different point of view, even from the get-go. In other words, you wanted to tell a story utilizing both character and image in a way that you say is not being done by others?
Oh, very much so, because, well, at the time, I was making mostly a reference to Montauk Chronicles, but Horror Business was very different because, there were other documentaries about the horror industry at the time. And again, they were very similar to each other. They would have the same usual suspects, and that's okay. And that's great for what they are. But I tried to do something a little different. I tried to give you a textured look an honest look at what, at that time, the independent aspiring horror filmmaker was doing. And sometimes it was very brutally honest. So I think some people were taken aback by it.
Well, give us an example. In other words, if you're being brutally honest about the independent horror movie experience as opposed to independent filmmakers in general, or is there a tremendous crossover? I would think there has to be a crossover, because making a film is really not easy.
No, and that's what I showed with that film. I think I showed the harsh reality of it. In other words, then there was a combination of personalities in there. But what it shows is okay, you grow up as a child. This is the generally all of us together, these filmmakers, we grow up loving movies and wanting to make them, but not exactly knowing what that means until you get into a situation where you have to make a movie now, and you're choosing to do that to survive and make a living out of it. And for a lot of people, it's a big mistake because it certainly isn't easy, and there are a lot of factors working against you from the beginning. So you have to be very clear as to if you're interested in being loved by a big audience, if that's your interest, then you must have the audience in mind when you're making the picture. If you simply do not care, or you're independently wealthy and you don't care about an audience, and you're just, I've heard people say, I'm making this film for myself, which I don't understand, because it's not like you're, you know, drinking a glass of wine and painting on a canvas. This is partially, it's as much as a business as it is an art form, and that needs to be understood when you're making a picture. And so, because it's so expensive to make.
Well, I'm a writer, and all my editors and all my heroes who I got to know as friends who are writers told me flatly, absolutely, make the novel, make the story, make the book that you're writing the one that you want to read, and then other people will find it.
So that's correct.
We will get back to this and discuss Montauk and where Chris's career went with all his experience learned on the first project right after these messages. And welcome back, everybody, to The Other Side of Midnight with my guest this morning, Christopher Garantano. We're discussing filmmaking and how one breaks into the business and the radical changes the technology has made that allows anyone with a modicum of talent to pick up a camera and actually begin to shoot something that someone else might want to see. So on that note, Chris, how did you move from the horror business, the horror chronicles, the horror genre, into exploring a real-world mystery that, I don't know whether it's horrible or not, but Montauk has certainly had a reputation over the years. What did you know when you started looking, and how did you proceed?
Well, I was familiar with the town of Montauk because I spent my summers there as a kid. And I wasn't, you know, that was the early 80s, so the story really wasn't out until the 90s. I think I was in high school or college when I got my hands on that first book by Preston Nichols. So I read that book, and I wasn't exactly impressed at how the information was laid out. You know, I was obsessed with mysteries of the world since I was a kid, and I have an extensive book collection that ranges from the time I was, I think, maybe 4 or 5 years old to now on those mysteries. But the Montauk book, I felt, was very thinly laid out. There wasn't a lot of information there.
What was the story? Because I've really kind of forgotten. There's been so much swirling around Montauk. Why don't you lay out the spine of the story and then start to tell us where you could add to it, or thought you could add to it?
Certainly. The story at that time, the general story, and even now, is a story of four men who regained their memories later in life. And the four men are Preston Nichols, Duncan Cameron, Alfred Bielek, and Stuart Swerdlow. Stuart Swerdlow came into the picture a little bit later. He wasn't around when the story was first being told. And so these men claim that they were part of a secret experiment that occurred deep beneath the Camp Hero Air Force Base in Montauk, New York, between 1971 and 1983.
That's a heck of a name for an Air Force base. Camp Hero.
Yeah. Right, originally Fort Hero. And it really is an Air Force base. It was an Air Force base.
Out at the end of the island, right?
yes, you could still, you know, unlike Area 51 or, you know, Wright-Patterson or any of those places, or Dulce, you can actually walk onto Camp Hero legally and explore legally to, you know, a degree that would be very satisfying, I think, to anybody interested in this story. You know, you could legally walk around the grounds, and there are acres and acres of land. So they claim that beneath the ground there were time travel experiments, there was reverse engineering of alien technologies, interstellar travel through wormhole technology.
Is this the so-called chair?
Yes, the Montauk chair. Again, derived from alien technology. Preston Nichols says that this chair was designed by him, and how he ingested the alien technology and utilized that knowledge to build the Montauk chair. And the Montauk chair was everything from a time transporter to also a machine that, if a powerful psychic was able to sit in the chair, if he was powerful enough, he could manifest his thoughts into physical reality, which they said they did.
You mean like matter replication or something?
Correct. Well, in most cases, Preston claimed that if Duncan or some other psychic was sitting in the chair, he could think of a glass, and the glass would appear in
just
physics.
Just like a Star Trek replicator.
Correct. And there are so many science fiction. You see, we're all familiar with science fiction. If you're not familiar with or the Twilight Zone. I mean, there were so many moments where I was like, this is a direct reference to the Twilight Zone. And even Preston himself said this reptilian creature that walked, you know, because there were extraterrestrials working there, according to the gentlemen that have told the tale for years, that there was a very intelligent reptilian commander, as he called it, approached him. And he looked just like the Gorn from Star Trek. So these were constant science fiction references. Even this creature that was manifested by the psychic at the end of the project, they crashed the project by manifesting the monster from the id from Forbidden Planet.
And this is exactly
what Preston told this tale using that reference. It was the monster from the id.
Now, what made you, A, think this could at all be real, and B, that you wanted to actually do a film about it?
Well, I didn't want to at first.
That's interesting. Why not?
Yeah. Well, I was one of the subjects. I befriended one of the subjects of Horror Business, and he at the time was working on a film in Las Vegas called Sins of Government. He knew I was from Long Island, and he knew I was interested in doing a paranormal docudrama next because it was one of my interests in my whole life. And I was going to choose something else. But he said, why don't you do a Montauk story? You lived out there. You've been there. You're familiar with the area. And I said, no, I'm not interested in that. I read the book, and I wasn't impressed, and I don't know if I believe it.
Hmm.
So, but a little bit later, I thought the prospect of visiting the men in their homes and then observing them as they tell this, you know, Z-grade science fiction story to me. At the time, that's how I felt.
You mean like almost like a field study, studying a wild animal in their native habitat?
Correct. I mean, I'm so interested in that. That's what Horror Business was. It wasn't, you know, I didn't want to show the glory. I wanted to show how difficult things were and see what I can find.
The real world behind the scenes.
Correct. Now, what was interesting to me was these men were telling this tale at that time for 20 years and or more, and they keep telling it. And I thought that alone was fascinating, so it started there. That's when I agreed. I said, okay, I'm going to do this, but that's how I want to see these men in their homes. I don't want to take them to a studio. I want them in their own home where they're comfortable.
Okay, let me ask you this. You're keying on the psychology. In other words, if these guys didn't have this experience, if they were just making it up, your question in your mind was, how can they make it up and keep making it up for 20 years?
Well, that's one of the questions in my mind was, because I know by that time they were starting to experience a lot of ridicule for it, they weren't making any money, really.
No.
And I was just curious as to why. I wanted to hear it from them. And so each man had a different vibe about him, you know, and I just wanted to experience it and capture it as a filmmaker. And
wow.
I think That's where the whole thing began. I didn't, you know, I'm not a scientist, and I'm not a conspiracy enthusiast per se, and certainly wasn't back then. So I just wanted to ingest the experience of first talking to these men, and then I started an investigation. This lasted 9 years, two movies.
My gosh, that's a long time. You talk about being focused on one thing for a long time, Christopher. You're kind of imitating your subjects. 9 years on one film?
It literally changed my life. By the end of it, I had no home. I ran out of money. I went through a lot to make this movie, and I made it twice. There was one feature-length version completed in December of 2011, and I wasn't happy with it, and I started all over again. I toured it around 2012 in different festivals and venues, and then finally in January of 2013, I began to make the movie that is out right now.
When you finally got what, in resonance, or you figured out some showstoppers?
No, well, I just wasn't happy with what I made. I felt like I could do better. And film technology, as we were just discussing, improved exponentially in those few years. And I wanted to, I got better, and I wanted to get my hands on that technology.
See, that's the mark of a true professional. When you look at your own work, and I must say I'm awful that way. You look at your own work and you say, oh, I can't put that out. I've got to. So in various books that I've been involved in, editors have actually had to come and steal the manuscript because I wouldn't let it go. I had one more thing to add, one more here, one, you know. So I understand that you can get caught up in the development of the technology that allows you to tell a better story. But you're saying that at the same time, you yourself were technically and critically getting better at being a storyteller with the technology, so you basically wanted to tell the story you knew you were capable of and not just put something out there.
Exactly.
So what happened to it?
Oh, the first version?
Yeah.
I canned it. Uh-huh. I had to retain Alfred Bielek's interviews because he passed away in 2011, yeah, and I started all over again.
From scratch?
From scratch in 2013.
Wow. And then in 2014, you took it to the Philip K. Dick Film Festival in New York. Philip K. Dick, of course, is a giant in the novel world, the sci-fi novel world. What was the film that they made, they adapted into, I guess it was Terminator, was a Philip K. Dick film that was adapted from Do Electric?
No, that's Blade Runner.
Blade Runner, I'm sorry. You're right. So anyway, Do Android's Dream, yes. So, and that was Blade Runner. So, you won a prize.
I did. It was Best Documentary Award.
Damn.
And I really liked the people that ran the festival because they really, you know, they were well-versed in Philip K. Dick, and they believed in his own paranoia and philosophy about the future and technology, and I don't know. I thought it was interesting, and I'm not really a big awards guy, and I could care less about film festivals. But I like people seeing the movie.
But as a filmmaker, you've got to know that the more of these festivals you notch in your belt, the more you will be given credibility to do something bigger and more imaginative.
That may have been the old rule, but I personally feel that if you make a picture and it's worth looking at, word is going to spread around the world somehow if you push it hard enough. And this is a time that's very different than it used to be. So all those old rules, I kind of know for a fact that they don't apply anymore. And now it's a new time. For instance, you know, Montauk Chronicles is really getting around. It's got to people around the world, you know, everywhere from California to Fiji. So I know this for a fact because those are the people that have ordered it. And, I hear from them every day, and they email me. Most people that have checked this film out are really into it and are really responding well to it. And I think that's what it's all about, because if you make a motion picture, do you really need to have anyone else's permission or anyone else's blessings on the picture for it to be good? Because I think if the larger industry is going to hire you, they would much rather hire someone like me who went through the whole process, literally is going to, you know, sold it, put it together, a professional product, got it out to people, as opposed to the guy who's just waiting by the door for some money mm-hmm. and a script. You know? And I think it's changed. It really has changed. And my goal isn't to get hired. It's to continue to make motion pictures. And I truly believe that the idea of it not being able to, the idea of an artist, a film artist, not being able to make a living off of making a movie these days is another thing that's thrown out there to keep them from doing it. I think that if you make something that's good, there are going to be people that want it, but you can't give it away when you finish. And I think that's the biggest mistake that a movie maker makes at the end of his project or her project, is that the first thing they're doing is seeking a distributor. Well, you know what a distributor is. It's someone who's going to take a lion's share of your hard work and give you very little and make you big promises, and in the end, you might not get any of them. So that's just a warning.
Well, you set up your end-to-end deal from, you know, production to distribution. How is that working out?
It's working out well. You know, I don't want to discuss publicly every penny, but I think that
We wouldn't ask.
Yeah, it's just getting to it's getting around people, and I have not invested money yet into advertising. I you know, because I'm working on a budget, but it, you know, we've sold a significant amount of copies of the Blu-rays and the DVDs. Next, there is interest in the U.S. license and the overseas license. I traveled to Hong Kong in 2012 to establish some bridges with people in the international market. And these are things you can do as a movie maker, but I think a lot of people, their first, you know, as filmmakers, you know, their first thing is to, wow, I'm done, and now I want people to love me at the film festival circuit. And I think I've known guys that have spent I personally spent years in the film festival circuit with my first film, and I just think these days it could be a waste of time. And I think for most movie makers, it is, because they're left dry at the end after years of trying to, you know. You know, a lot of these film festivals charge you $50 to get in, just to enter your film. And if you don't get in the festival, they're going to still take your money.
Well, that's typical.
Right, but I feel that...
like a registration fee or something. Look, if you think film festivals are obsolete, why did you go? Because if you hadn't gone, you wouldn't have won.
No. I don't think they're obsolete. I just felt that why... Okay, a lot of the film festivals don't care about projection. Now... you're inviting all these people to a festival. Don't you think the sound and picture should be at its optimum quality?
Kind
of. And a lot of festivals just, they'll project it on a wall and it'll be blown out. And yeah, and it won't look correct.
But that's the central part of a film festival is the damn films. How can you project on, I mean, you know, that's obviously not a proper conference to go to anyway, so.
So I had bad experiences at film festivals just with the presentation. And I just feel like, there's no taboo in a filmmaker making his picture and getting it out directly to the audience. That's a joke that was thrown out there to distract you. I think that if someone is willing to pay a few bucks to watch your picture, you've made it. Now, if you can get 10 people to pay for it that aren't your Aunt Franny or your mother, then you can get 100. If you can get 100, you can get 1,000. There are a lot of people in this world, you know, 7+ billion people in the world.
But Chris, I know a lot of filmmakers, obviously. Not a lot of them have all the prerequisite skills to handle a studio. Because basically you're talking a studio from end to end, from making a film to distributing a film to a global audience. There's very few people who are both economically available to do that, or psychologically, or even educationally prepared to handle all those diverse, complicated details to get your film to a mass market. I mean, that's why distributors have a business, because most filmmakers want to make film.
I just feel if the distributors want to really continue with their business, because they might lose it soon, they need to invest some money into stopping the thievery that's going on.
Yes. Paul Davids has talked to me about piracy. It's horrible.
Sure.
You want to spend a few minutes talking about piracy? Because that's the downside. That's kind of the horror of the independent film business.
Yeah. I mean, these guys aren't heroes, you know, and I pay for any movie I watch, and that's a fact. Because the thing is, if you if this is what makes the world go round. Now, if you continue to steal these movies, the rich guys aren't the ones losing money, really. It's the guys like us who worked really hard to get a job in the industry that are going to get canned because they're going to scale things down and they're going to get rid of guys that they feel like they can, that are expendable. And, you know, the larger companies just want to save money, and that's why they, you know, a lot of people claim they're not selling product, they're just trying to sell files. But I think you have a leg up if you're willing to invest the time and you're willing to invest the money into printing product, hard copies, meaning Blu-rays and DVDs, mm-hmm. you know, you can make a living off of it. But the thing is, not everyone can do it, because this is what I'm getting back to what we were talking about earlier about, okay, make the film you want to make. That's great. But if you're interested in even making a penny, you better consider the audience. If you don't care at all, then make whatever movie you want to make. You can make Andy Warhol's Empire. What was it? 8 hours of one stack shot of the Empire State Building. You know, no one's going to buy it. But, you know, so to deal with the piracy, I've been able to do my best with it. And it's been somewhat effective. And I'm baffled at the larger industry not being able to control it, because I have no money and I was able to wrangle it in a little bit, you know, or a significant amount to keep it tame. And, you know, in the past, I mean, my first movie was pirated, and it's detrimental, because if something's done about it, then it won't be a detriment anymore. You know,
well, I mean, this to me represents the other problem of independent filmmaking, which is if you can't make a film and sell it and make money so you can make your next film. That's why a studio with lawyers and accountants and a lot of clout and a lot of backup, so you can land on the offenders with, you know, the full wrath of whatever studio. How does an indie make it in this jungle, dog eat dog, shark eat shark? How are you able to curb the piracy, you said, to some degree?
Oh, it's a variety of action taken. I mean,
like?
the piracy ranges from people uploading things on the easiest accessible places like YouTube and stuff to, file sharing sites. And each of those places have a place where you can send in, you know, copyright takedown notices, legal notices, and a lot of the people comply and take it down. But in the case of, you know, the largest studios protecting you, all of their movies are being stolen right now and they're losing money. So I don't know how well they're going to do. But to answer your question as to what an independent filmmaker should do to make it in this world, first of all, know what you're doing. You're not going to go and perform a surgery if you don't know what you're doing. And you're not going to go and try and be the head contractor on the construction of a large house. So why on earth would you try and make a motion picture if you don't know what you're doing? So go learn first. Second, have a passion for it. And third, if you're going to spend the time to make a feature-length motion picture, pour your brain, your imagination, your heart out into this thing. Put everything you have into it, and I guarantee something's going to come from it. But you need to know what you're doing first. Be well-versed in movie making.
Film
history.
Chris, which is another way of saying make the movie you want to see.
Correct.
Because if you're not excited about your project, if you don't really love every aspect of doing it, it's going to show.
I agree. And that's why I felt the first version of Montauk wasn't satisfactory. And so the second one, I did have a passion for, and I wanted to start all over again, and that's what I did
in 2013. And it's simply the technological revolution plus your own learning curve that kind of brought you to this enthusiastic point?
That, and I felt like I detached from my hatred for the idea of the Montauk project that I started with. I should have never made.
Oh, this is interesting. Your what?
Yeah.
Your hatred of Montauk?
Yeah, well, I started with no interest in the project. And so I think that seed carried on through the first film.
But wait. Hatred is an active emotion. Not interested is passive. There's
okay,
a million things we are not interested
in. I'll try and clarify. So when I started, I wanted to begin on a different paranormal mystery, something that I really enjoyed reading about from my childhood up until that point. When I decided to dismiss that project and move forward with the Montauk project, a study of that, I wasn't interested in it, but I was going forward anyway, and I was reluctant. And I think that carried on throughout the picture, and I never fully was interested in it. And as we were just discussing, you need to be 100% interested in the project you're making.
Well, particularly if you're sacrificing your house and your car and your marriage and your dog.
Yes,
and
I did. So moving on to 2013, I made sure I was interested because I could have just let it be and put it out. And
so what? See, I want to know what changed. What suddenly got you riveted by this story?
Well, in 2006, I met Stuart Swerdlow. He was the third subject that I met along the way. First was Alfred Bielek. Then I spoke with Preston Nichols, and then I moved on to Stuart Swerdlow. There was something really interesting about visiting Swerdlow because he was distinctly different from the other two men in the sense where the other two men could be classified as hermits. And they had a strangeness about them, and you've seen them in interviews. You know, they're telling you everything that from vampires are real to, you know, Alfred Bielek claiming that, you know, he was age regressed three times he had blood coming from his nose and his arms. And I think he was just taking a blood thinner, but he said that it was because his molecular structure was breaking down.
Hmm.
And so then moving there and then moving on to Stuart Swerdlow's.
Well, hang on a sec. Hang on. There is another friend of mine who has been, I need to be careful how I say this because I don't want to give away names or identities or whatever, but he's been involved in Deep Black projects. Yeah. He has been involved in projects where his exposure to, shall we say, unusual radiations appears to have been part of the job description. And he is now not in good health because of this. So his health kind of mirrors the very unusual environment in which he operated and the various procedures he underwent. So there's a consistency there that, in fact, is also with those two other guys. I mean, you look at their state of health and you ask yourself, did something really unusual happen to them?
Yes, yes. But I was, but this, we're rewinding back to 06, and I was very, I have a different point of view now, obviously, but back in 06, I was very critical of it. I had a disdain for the project. And so I entered with saying, now I'm going to go listen to somebody who's insane, because this was, remember in 06, it wasn't the zeitgeist. It was a very obscure paranormal mystery. It wasn't as nearly as popular as it was even a few years ago. So when I spoke to Alfred Bielek, I just went from being a kid who loved science fiction and loved horror, and now I have an old man telling me everything I learned in fiction, science fiction and horror and fantasy, is all real.
Wow.
A lot to take in one shot in 06, with, you know, when that wasn't a very popular thing either, the Montauk Project.
Yeah, particularly with a cynical young guy who hates his subject and thinks all these people are totally lying.
Well, not cynical, just so used to fiction and not, let's say, I mean, rightfully so, walking into a situation where unless you have something to show me, why should I believe you?
Okay, well, hold it there because we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will hear, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. You're listening, excuse me, I need more water. You're listening to The Other Side of Midnight. My guest this morning is Chris Gaetano. And we're talking about film and Montauk and things that go bump in the night.
Short maps, bad rats and short maps.
I'm talking with Christopher Garitano, this morning, and we're talking about film, we're talking about Montauk, we're talking about how you went from disinterest to fascination because of, I guess, one guy.
No, it wasn't one guy. It was just the moment. It's such a contrast between Stuart Swerdlow and Alfred Bielek and Preston Nichols, I guess, could be categorized as a, if you were to first meet them. I don't, you know, look, I didn't.
Well, I met Al. I met Al several times.
I understand
I
where
loved
you
Al.
Them and your lineage, but my lineage was a guy who was into science fiction and horror. And when I ran into these guys, I was literally sitting in front of an old man who was telling me that every fantasy was real. And of course, I was taught not to believe people until they had at least a little something to show me. So that's where I started. But the contrast between Al Bielek, Preston Nichols, and Stuart Swerdlow is a big difference. And I got to Stuart Swerdlow's home. He wasn't living alone in a small little room. And at that time, Al was, and Preston was living by himself in a strange, dilapidated house on a hill, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Stuart Swerdlow lives in an affluent neighborhood. He has a family. He has children. He has people that respect him. And it was interesting because he was telling the same story, and I couldn't figure him out. You know, and I'm just telling you from the perspective of 2006, I have a very different perspective now. We're talking 9 years in this investigation. This is not something I would have stuck to if I had no interest in it.
You know, the thing that intrigues me, Chris, about this is they tell you when you're writing a book or a script or whatever, the character is everything. And to me, the most interesting character in this project so far is you, because your transformation from being bored and going through the motions to actually really getting into this, to me, is fascinating. And it seems to be through a guy who, unlike the other two protagonists in this story, looked very normal. In other words, he had all the outward appearances of American middle class, good family, good home, good neighborhood, good friends. So you're listening to a story, the same story, but it's coming to you in a different package.
Correct. And at the time, you know, I took everything, of course, with a grain of salt, as they say. And, you know,
you were a hard case. You were a real... What were you doing in this field?
What field? The field of movie making?
No, the field of movie making about strange things that go bump in the night that you don't believe in.
Well,
and you want to do a documentary as opposed to a fictional treatment.
No. Strange things that go bump in the night that I don't believe in, it wasn't the case. This was the Montauk Project. And this wasn't Strange Things That Go Bump in the Night. And the Montauk Boys Program, again, we're rewinding back to 06. We need to go forward a little bit on this.
Okay.
We're rewinding back to 06. At the time, the Montauk story, or at least the one I was familiar with in the first book, did not at all focus on the Montauk Boys Program, which is what my motion picture focuses on mainly, even though it tells the whole tale. You know, I just felt...
Hang on, let me stop you there.
Yes.
The Montauk Boys Project?
Correct.
What the heck is the Montauk Boys Project? I've never heard of it.
Quite palatable as a conspiracy was that the Montauk Boy Program was essentially akin to what they say MKUltra was, but down at the bottom of Camp Hero, and that... According to Alfred Bielek, Stuart Swerdlow, and Preston Nichols, I mean, this was the whole project, by the way, that hundreds of thousands in a 13-year period, hundreds of thousands of children were kidnapped, murdered, and brutalized during these experiments for the purpose of fracturing their minds and implementing mind control into them, to create a variety of everything from spies to psychic soldiers to Manchurian candidate type assassins. And this is what these men say happened in that period of time, and that these boys were given heavy amounts of hallucinogens, LSD, experimental hallucinogens. They were beaten half to death, and they were utilized in these mind control experiments as guinea pigs. that to me was very believable.
That's a very heavy accusation.
Well, it wasn't my accusation. It was their explanation of the three men who originated this tale.
Still makes it heavy.
I mean, sure,
this is not the side of Montauk that we've been hearing about publicly.
Oh no, it's been out there, and it's been one of the main pieces of it. It's just the science fiction story that was told in the 90s omitted it, in the 90s. And so in the 2000s, that's when the voice program and the idea of the programming, I think, really started to surface heavily. I think it was mentioned slightly in the book, but Stuart Swerdlow later came out with a book, and then of course Preston Nichols acknowledged this, Alfred Bielek acknowledges this, all in my picture, it's all in the movie. As a documentarian, what I'm doing is I'm observing. I can't shove my opinion down your throat. That wouldn't be a documentary, would it? It would be my opinion.
Well, documentaries do have points of view. I mean, filmmakers, all kinds of filmmakers I know have points of view.
No. But what I wanted to do was allow the audience to accompany me on the journey. So you hear my voice. I partially narrate the picture, and I do explain to you how I felt about it, and very honestly that I didn't believe it, but I wanted to continue forward with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, and the thing that allowed me and made me want to go back was, again, my experience at the Swerdlows. I just couldn't wrap my head around it. But by the end of the three-day period, and this was in 06, I was really convinced that all of this was true. And it started to truly disturb me.
Wait a minute. Did anybody show you any evidence, or is it all stories?
No, there were no artifacts shown to me, no pictures, no documents. But I think the true world history that Stuart Swerdlow was explaining to me and how all of this originated, because for you to believe in any of this, of course, and I'm somewhat familiar with your own lineage, Richard, so I know that you have a lot of information to back up your claims, but we're not, you know, you have to understand my perspective. I didn't go into this as a scientist or someone who had a history of obsession with conspiracies. I think that hinders you, and I was the best candidate for this job because I can give you an unbiased approach. And so that's why I did it. I felt it would be the best observation of this because I wasn't going to load you up with esoteria that I can't prove and just reiterate things that were in a book before. I wanted to give you a fresh perspective, and that's what I gave you. I gave you a universal perspective, a perspective of a man who came in as a layman, you know, and wanted to just absorb it fresh with a clean slate. And so that's where I started.
I'm just fascinated by the contrast between these various players. So you visited Swerdlow for 3 days. He told you the story and told you. Something in that conversation made you shift?
It wasn't just the conversation. It was all of his visitors, his family, his children, his father-in-law. Mm-hmm. Everybody had the same point of view. And it just started to make some sense. I mean, you know, listen, every Sunday we have people around this world that visit their churches or their synagogues, and they pray to imaginary creatures and beings every day. I mean, you know, it just happens, you know, spirits and beings from other dimensions. But those same people would doubt this whole situation entirely. And of course, if we're just talking about basic information here, and we're talking about from the point of view of most people, not the people who are well-versed in everything. I didn't make the movie for them in particularly. I made it for anyone who would access it. So we have to start from the beginning, and we have to start from the perspective of someone like myself.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the best perspective. It's the most unbiased perspective. So I think being exposed to, for the very first time, what appeared to me and what I believe were sound-minded people of all types who weren't putting on a show, because I was looking for that. I was like, now, is this a show? You know, I had breakfast with them. I had dinner with them. They had different visitors throughout the weekend, and everybody believed.
So,
did
you stay with them, or did you stay at a motel and then go visit?
At that particular time, I stayed at a motel. I have since stayed at Stuart Swerdlow's home to continue my work on the film.
So, you've been able to observe the family close up.
Yes, and I've seen the work he puts into. Now, fast forwarding many years. Okay,
hang on a sec. Let me ask this question: if you have three people of very different characters and personas, and they're all telling you the same story. Two of them are kind of outcasts, iconoclasts, loners, however you'd want to describe that. I mean, certainly Al, when I met him, he was a loner.
Yes.
But you say Mr. Swerdlow was a family man, community person, family, yes, house, job, friends. In other words, the packaging was totally normal, but the story was the same. So here's, yes, my question. How do you know if mind control and mind-altering technology is employed to change 100,000 kids that they've abducted from somewhere into a program, how do you know that these three people are not regurgitating what they were programmed by someone to tell you?
I don't, and I don't to this day, and I don't claim to know, and I never have.
But isn't that important?
No. What's important is that we need to continue to do research. And in my picture, we contrast and compare to things that have happened, at least in this country. Okay, we can go back in, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years. But if we look back in this country in the last, you know, 50 years even, we had two programs that were being conducted that are almost identical. Okay, one of which was the MKUltra program, mm-hmm, which our President Bill Clinton apologized for in 1995. And, you know, also he made it look like he was apologizing for the Tuskegee experiments as if they weren't just as bad,
mm-hmm,
where men and women were given syphilis unbeknownst,
right,
to them,
right,
under,
right,
false pretenses. So,
well, that's the big background of this whole story. If it's true, or even if parts of it are true, it implies, actually pretty directly, that there's a huge government-funded program, American taxpayer program, designed to kidnap American citizens, do awful things to them in secret to find out various parameters of mind control, then put them out there in society to represent something, some point of view, some agenda, some project, some mission, all without our knowledge and our permission and, of course, the permission of the Constitution.
It's a possibility, a strong one, I believe. That's my opinion. Because if they were capable of doing it twice, and there were reports about this, and then recently there was something in Florida where they actually found corpus delicti. They found bodies of children in something called, underneath something called the Dozier School, which is eerily familiar.
I remember that story vividly.
Correct. Eerily familiar to this situation. And, you know, I have a feeling that, okay, you know, and one of the theories that I had, because I don't know which one I fully believe, it's not like I'm disregarding alien technology or extraterrestrial existence. I believe in 100%. I believe in the possibility of time travel. I believe in a lot of things. But this particular tale, just because those things may exist, and just because interstellar travel through wormholes and visits to Mars and extraterrestrials existing and coming to our planet and interacting with us may very well exist, does not mean that every tale that's told is true.
Of course.
And that's something that I wanted to focus on, because we need to be cautious, because there are a lot of hucksters out there. There are a lot of people, you know, getting up and saying, I'm Spartacus. You know, they just want to be part of it as well. And I've experienced that in the last year or so. I've had a lot of people contact me that said they were all part of the Montauk Project.
Hmm.
I mean, who do you believe? You can't just believe anything else.
Well, see, that's so, part of the question. What was your criteria for deciding that this story, A, was likely true, and B, it had to be told?
Well, I got to the point where it started to make some sense when I studied more about MKUltra, and I realized, you know, when people like Christine Nicola came and spoke before that congressional hearing in 95, and I saw those videos and I read more about it, and I read about the Tuskegee experiments, I guess, and I had someone, after I was on Coast to Coast AM, approach me via email, and this particular person worked for a major chemical company in the 70s, around the same time that the alleged Montauk Project was occurring. And they said that they were overseeing documents for a highly experimental alloy that was being shipped not only to Brookhaven Labs, but also Camp Hero. Now, and that names and dates and people check out on those documents because they are similar names, or the same, I'm sorry, the same names that Preston Nichols has mentioned in the past. And then my experience sitting with Nichols the second time for the movie that I just put out, he had an interesting way about him that was quite different than the first time. The first time I could have sworn he was on something. You know, I've seen people on hallucinogens before, and he had the, you know, I have the video. You could see it for yourself, but I didn't use
or,
that interview.
Or maybe like he was programmed?
Well, yes, I did consider that, and I consider that. I believe that more now because the second time around, we had a great conversation, but he was very uncomfortable with the mentioning of the boys, even though he told all about the brutality of the programs and admitted his involvement. The thing is, Preston grew up on science fiction, and Preston grew up with technology. And when an opportunity arises for someone who doesn't have a love interest, doesn't have really a family or a care in the world outside of science fiction and the technology that he's obsessed and loves, if you were to present the opportunity to have your hands on alien technology, you know, extraterrestrial technology, and be able to work alongside these things and now live in this wonderful world that you would hope to be a part of, I think that's what drew him in, because at the end of the conversation, I said, even if boys were being used again, you would be part of this again. And he said, without question.
Fascinating.
So, yeah.
So this is how you buy certain people.
Buy them, meaning believe everything they're saying?
No, this is, in other words, if you have all this super stuff going on behind the scenes and you need talented people to make it work, to run projects, to run missions, to run, you know, what's your inducement to get them to basically turn their back on everything that is ethical or normal? Obviously, you fingered the trigger for this individual, which was the idea of being in the candy store.
Oh, yeah. I
mean, and that was most important.
Yeah, this is a man who must have grown up isolated, who was socially awkward, and who really didn't have a care in the world but for his science fiction stories and the technology. So then he's exposed to this incredible universe and doesn't want to leave it, you know, and I guess that's what kept him there. I mean, but he's had a lot of tales to tell. I mean, you know, he basically told me he worked on the sound for Star Wars, which may have been true, but he's uncredited, and we couldn't find any documentation for that.
Did he tell you who he worked with?
Well, he said he worked with George Lucas. He said he also worked with Stanley Kubrick. He referred to him as Stan on 2001: A Space Odyssey. Hmm. Once again, uncredited, but Stanley Kubrick was in New York at that time. And he did hire some fringe element guys to work on his pictures. He wasn't usually, you know, I mean, I think maybe at that time was the end of it, but then he moved to England and started working with whoever the hell he wanted to work with. But, I mean, it's possible, but there's still no documentation of it. But Preston seems to have a lot of information, and he does seem to have a knowledge of these things. Now, when I visited him, he had this kind of makeshift bed with a series of lights above it, in his lab, as he called it. And he said that this was a derivative of Montauk technology, you know, the Montauk chair, and that it would alter your DNA, of course, in a positive way, that it would heal you, heal all your cells. I said, okay, sign me up. I'm going in. And so I laid in this platform, and he would turn on music. There was a series of speakers around this platform. And he put on the Doors or put on Jimi Hendrix, and then these lights would start shining, and he says, well, now it's working. Now it's doing its work on you. I didn't feel any different. And, you know, that was my experience with him the first time. It was like he was showing me this machine that he built. It seemed like, you know, a makeshift machine, but to this day, I don't know exactly what the thing did to me, if it did anything. I guess I wouldn't know unless someone would attest it. But, you know, I still gave these guys every opportunity to tell their tale without judging them or me coming to any kind of major conclusion. Remember, I started that way, but I ended up very differently, believing in a good deal of it. At this point, my point of view is that I believe something happened beneath Camp Hero for sure. I don't know to the extent that the men are telling, because some of it just seems like so similar to every, you know, Z-grade science fiction story that I've heard, you know, the crescendo at the end, releasing the giant beast into the basin, you know, saving the day. It sounds like an old serial.
It does kind of sound like Tom Swift and his electric monster disintegrator.
Sure. And so wouldn't you believe it, as one possibility, and I've never said exactly what this thing was, and I won't until I know for sure, but is it a possibility that there was something similar to MKUltra going on down there, and maybe there was alien technology being used down there as well? And what better way to cover it up than to create the Z-grade science fiction story to use as a veil to cover the whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a possibility, and I do talk about that in the picture, but I encourage the people who watch my picture and in the picture in my narration to do your own research, and I give you as many avenues to go after the, you know, towards the end of the film to look for. And
let me get this straight. You're thinking as part of your parallel process that maybe the story that they're telling is an elaborate cover story to hide another secret project that they really couldn't talk about.
Sure. Well, if you think about it, if you were running a secret project that at the very least had, you were illegally murdering people and kidnapping people. There are legal murders, of course, in war, but, you know, you were legally, you know, you were kidnapping people, murdering citizens, and this has been done before, okay? You know, and so what better way to cover it, especially if there are drugs involved, than to implant the idea of something much less believable in the minds of potential survivors? So I considered that a possibility, yes.
Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive, which only goes to show we need more practice.
Correct.
So we're involved in a government conspiracy to do what at Montauk? What's the central essence of what they were trying to do?
Well, I suppose, according to all of the information that I gathered over time, was that they were aiming to develop a mass mind control situation.
You mean for the population of the world?
For the entire populace. For the United States or for New York to begin with, and then implemented, because Alfred Bielek said that there were similar programs going on all over the United States and all over the world, and they were extremely similar and connected to Montauk. You know, he had also said that there were, as he referred to, Leviton-trained systems underneath the entire United States, and that you could travel from New York to California in 2 hours.
Did you ever see Gene Roddenberry's work after Star Trek?
Regarding...
Well, he had a motion picture which was broadcast on television called, I think, Earth 2. It was set after a nuclear holocaust. You know, the world's trying to pick up the pieces. People have reverted to savagery in many areas. I mean, there's just a few people left. It's been a decimation of the global population. And there's this cadre of technologically advanced folks in some kind of a core, some kind of a mission, or some kind of a division, which basically goes around the country and tries to bring back to a central headquarters bits and pieces of surviving knowledge and technology and people that may have skills or whatever. And the system that Gene created, like he created the transporter on Star Trek to get people quickly from point A to point B, he created what he called a sub-shuttle system, which was a series of underground trains in vacuum-evacuated tunnels that had been dug all throughout the country, underlying the continent, and you were able to traverse from point A to point B very quickly and get to the locale of a new story in what he envisioned was a series to ultimately follow Star Trek, because the movie was, of course, the pilot. Now, I have suspected, based on intel people I've talked to, that Gene may have known something more about the reality of an underground train system than anyone has given him credit for in many, 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 many years. And what you're saying is these guys basically were talking about the same thing, except they said it's real.
Yes, yes. They said it's real. And then wasn't it recently, I think, that Google, or the company behind Google, you know, that's making all of that money every day.
Oh, it's Google.
Said that they established a very similar train system that will be implemented in Los Angeles, between Los Angeles and Las Vegas, something like that.
Yeah.
So Bielek talked about this in 06. This was announced by Google, I think, and maybe a year or so ago. You know, and of course, we're not allowed, as the public, allowed to know about technologies until 10 years after they're developed. I mean, you know, the internet was developed quite some time ago.
So it started as ARPANET. I actually used it in its very fledgling form. It wasn't done in secret. It was just done quietly, if anybody had been paying attention. It was when it was commercialized in the 80s, in the 90s, certainly the 90s, that everybody realized it had Defense Department origins. But it wasn't a secret. It just wasn't widely known.
Sure. I mean, could that be the case with a lot of these other technologies? You know, I think you just made a point. The thing is, a lot of people don't realize, you know, I'd say the majority of the population aren't aware of what's out there because they don't do their research. You know, they're not aware of, you know, the infinite amount of solar systems and galaxies that are out there and the highest probability that most of this science fiction is most likely real. You know, they're not aware of that. So it's somehow they need to be reminded to, you know, take the time out and just do a little, you know, rudimentary research. You know, just go out and just do research, because most people haven't. You know, they don't have the knowledge that you have. And so it has to be taken with that approach to encourage them and to remind them, you know, to step away from what's distracting them, which is, you know, the television. I haven't watched television in 2 years.
I tend to watch a bit of television from time to time.
Well, I like... You know, I'll go back and watch old Twilight Zone episodes or even modern television shows in some other way, you know, like on Netflix or something. But I want to stay away from the commercials, and I try and stay away from the news programs. I think those are the biggest mind control implements that are out there. And even Preston Nichols agrees that, you know, so I shut it off on purpose because I wanted to see what it was like to turn it back on just for a moment. And I did not too long ago. And it really is just this barrage of, you know, heartbreaking, depressing, spirit-breaking imagery and ideas.
Yeah, that kind of describes television. On that note, we will take a short break. We'll be back with my guest on the other side of midnight shortly. I'm talking with Christopher Garitano. We're talking about Montauk, and is it real or is it Memorex? We'll be right back. Garitano. We're talking about Montauk. We're talking about potentially an extraordinary crime against humanity in the kidnapping, abduction, and murder of many of the 100 plus thousand children, I guess boys mostly, or all solely, and you'll tell me that in a moment, that were kidnapped as part of this secret program, according to these three witnesses, as reported in Chris's film, The Montauk Chronicles. Do you really, really, really think that 100,000 kids could have been kidnapped in those years and nobody would notice? I mean, there would have to be a trail.
I agree. I mean, but I tried to wrap my head around this because it's such a huge number. But I think what the men were trying to say was collectively in these programs, not just Montauk, in a 13-year period. And they side-reference... you know, South America, larger numbers and shorter periods of time of children go missing in that number. So
are we talking like a boys in Brazil scenario?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's hard to wrap your head around a lot of this, you know. But then if you start to do what I found that was quite fascinating and very scary was, okay, you're at first you can always assume that this is just unbelievable. The number's unbelievable. But if you start to peel the onion back and do a little research on the subject matter, it's not so unbelievable anymore, because you start to discover cases that are well documented where, you know, these numbers are high and maybe just as high. Or, like I said, I started to do some research on the Tuskegee experiments and MK Ultra, which in some cases is identical to many of the things that these men claim happened in Montauk. Doesn't mean that it happened in Montauk, but, you know,
see, there, we know every year there are, and I don't have the stats in front of me, but we know there's a lot of kids that just go missing. I mean, that's a fact. The problem I'm having with this particular story is, if some of them went missing and wound up in Montauk, when you have all those frenetic parents and all those police organizations looking and looking, and APBs and, you know, coast-to-coast milk cartons and all that, you would think there would be some random 1, 2, 3, 5, whatever, that could be traced independently to this project on Long Island if 100,000 people came through their doors and almost nobody left.
I agree with you, but I think the large numbers, I think the larger numbers that they do claim were runaway kids that have been forgotten, or they would take orphaned kids, you know, derelict kids where, in a way, they're expendable and wouldn't be missed. And these are Stuart Swerdlow's words, or Alfred Bielek's words, or Preston Nichols' words, saying that's specifically what they were looking for. They would pick up runaway kids in New York City or Long Island that were just kind of gone already. Nobody cared about them anymore.
In this same time frame, in the late 90s through the 2000s, I remember there was an NBC network television show, and I cannot for the life of me remember the name of the show, but the story arc, the narrative was a school with a whole bunch of kidnapped kids who were super genius level, who were being trained and programmed and molded into becoming agents able to carry out the wishes of the U.S. government in any one of 1,000 different venues. That sounds awfully similar.
Identical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I'm wondering,
the program that you saw, now that was proven, correct?
No. I'm trying to remember. It was a fictional television series on NBC, and the recurring character was the guy who had been kidnapped and was, when he became an adult, he was very adept at all kinds of disguises and taking over roles and doing professions that were basically lies, because he knew enough knowledge to, like, pretend to be a brain surgeon but not really be a brain surgeon, that kind of thing. And I'm trying to remember the name of the TV show. Someone, if we have time, you know, when we open the lines, if we do open the lines, and I don't want to do that until you've covered everything you want to cover this morning, but that TV show seems so eerily like this scenario.
Very much so. I wish I knew. Now, this was in
our vast audience will send me a note, or they'll send me an email, or they'll send me an IM, or they'll send me something, or they'll send it to Scotty, and he'll type it in Skype, or someone will get back to us this morning with the name of this TV show. Because what I'm getting at is, if this was real, how could you keep something so big, particularly if you're in a media situation where you kind of know some things are going on that you can't talk about? Is it not possible that NBC chose to make a fictional series based on this idea, having gotten the idea from reality?
Well, that's the idea. I mean, that's what Stuart Swerdlow had said, that they put these things out in movies, so, of course, the public would immediately associate the idea with a motion picture. And they've been doing it for years, they claim. So, I how can we confirm this, Richard? That's the idea. I want you to tell me, because you have a vast knowledge of the situation. What would you do to suggest someone to confirm this information or things like this? Where do you cross-reference it? How do you confirm it, or should you confirm it?
Okay.
Is credible witness enough?
Did you have any of your principals, the three guys, regressed?
I asked them if they would take lie detector tests.
Polygraph.
But polygraphs, correct. And they said that they're inconsistent and they weren't interested in taking them.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes. So that was the answer. It doesn't mean they're liars. You know, again, you know.
But you asked each one of these independently, right?
Yes, I did.
And
yes,
all
did.
Three said no.
They all said no. They don't. They believe
see,
that they're completely.
See, that to me is a red flag, because in most legal situations where you've been accused of a crime, what people would like to do is to be unaccused as quickly as possible, so they volunteer, unless it's some huge, enormous, incredible crime, and they obviously are somehow implicated, but they would like a polygraph, because the polygraph, even if it isn't perfect, will give a gist of most of the story is true, or most of their reporting is true, because everybody has failures of memory, they have, you know, emotional transience, you know, polygraph people have to be really good to extract the signal from the noise. But the fact that these guys didn't want to go anywhere near it, I find intriguing, because that would tend to make one think they didn't want to be probed too deeply.
Agreed. And but there is one subject at the end. He asked for his identity to be concealed. He claims that he was in the Montauk Project later on, a version of it, a few years after it apparently was shut down in 83. He has to be called James Bruce in this picture. I met him, actually. He wrote to me online when I was almost finished with the second version of the film, and I felt his story was intriguing enough for me to put my film on hold for almost another year. And he agreed to take the polygraph test. He okay. claims that he was one of the Montauk boys.
Okay, and what did you find out?
It was at the very end. I wanted to begin to hear his tale, because I could only fit so much after completing the picture. I wanted to at least initialize the idea of him in the picture. He's in it about 15 minutes, and I'm working on a follow-up called Ghosts of Montauk, where we're literally going to go to the grounds, bring a cadaver dog. I'm going to conduct a polygraph test with James Bruce. I'm going to go back to Preston Nichols and ask him to demonstrate the technology for the audience. I'm speaking to this person who worked for this chemical company in the 70s, and to display possibly an artifact, or at least give us as much information as possible.
What was Fort Hero doing before it got taken over for this secret project?
Well, it was the radar, the SAGE radar technology, semi-automatic ground environment technology, was rendered obsolete by satellite technology, mm-hmm. and the radar slowly moved its way out of the base because, of course, you know, we don't have to defend ourselves from Nazis anymore, and the technology was becoming obsolete, and whatever they were developing, this is the public, this is what they put out in the public, but whatever they were developing there was finished. And so the facility was over, and it was slowly dissipating, and apparently they shut it down in 83.
But again, with something so out there, and given the number of people that these guys are claiming came through the gates, why would you locate such an incendiary secret project in one of the most populated corridors of the United States, the Northeast on Long Island, unless you had to have access to, like, Brookhaven or major universities or who knows? But it just seems to me putting something that dangerous in terms of exposure in that place would not have been prudent. So why was it done?
Montauk was quite isolated for some time, especially in the winter months. It's like a ghost town. Even now, you know, you can walk around Camp Hero in the winter. There's barely anybody there. It's starting to grow a little bit, but the population was always small. And even to the population then, when the Air Force topside, okay, was apparent, they concealed themselves as a fishing village. It was always covert. It was always protected. The way it's geographically configured in that town, again, Montauk's quite isolated. Montauk Point's a very isolated place, even now, even though the population's higher. And in regard to Brookhaven Lab, I don't know if you know this, but the story that Bielek, Nichols, and Swerdlow told, in part was the operation of Project Paperclip Nazi scientists, after they were kicked out by Congress, left Brookhaven Labs and moved over to Camp Hero to work in the Montauk Project.
Wait, this is what they say. Back up. When did Congress kick out the paperclip guys?
Oh, year. I mean, when was it in the 50s?
No.
Yeah,
we never kicked them out. We accepted them. We brought them over.
Sure, no.
And then we put them to work in all the aerospace industries that existed.
Correct, but wasn't it that they were released eventually because it was just their work was over?
Oh, yeah, well, being kicked out and being released so they could go and become private citizens and maybe become American citizens. Yeah, that was an evolutionary process. Because
but
right
Congress
after the war,
didn't have an issue with them in the end.
I'm trying to remember what the specifics were. I mean, this has been a very dark part of American history. It's not been widely publicized. We do know that there were more than a few hundred people that came over, German scientists and engineers, and
yes,
other Germans, and they were basically let loose in American industry. One very famous guy wound up running Bell Aerospace. That is the company that makes not only the Bell helicopter there in New York, but also ultimately wound up creating the engines, particularly the second stage engine for the lunar ascent module to take off from the moon. The guy running that company was a dyed-in-the-wool Nazi, a Nazi general from Germany.
No, and then what year was it that they were denied any more access?
I don't remember offhand.
Because I think that's a fact. Now, again, this is, staying in the tradition of the fact that me just collecting the stories from these men, allowing them to tell their tale, and then displaying it for the audience. That was my goal.
Okay.
So that's what.
So
I
all right. I want to do two things because we only got a few minutes left, maybe about 10 minutes. One thing I want to do is I want to find out where people can see the Montauk Chronicles.
Currently, if you're interested in seeing Montauk Chronicles, you can visit our website at montaukchronicles.com. You can order either a Blu-ray or a DVD. They're loaded with extras, the Blu-ray having the most. Or you could go to amazon.com and order Montauk Chronicles.
And we have a link for that up in the Radio with Pictures section on your website tonight, on your web page on our website.
Yes, it is, and thank you very much.
Now, number two. You mentioned a little while ago, a few minutes ago, that you're working on part two?
Yes, I just started shooting footage for Ghosts of Montauk because I felt that the first volume, which is 2 hours long, needed to establish the story as it was told by the men who originated the tale. And that's what, as a movie maker and a storyteller, you can't really jam-pack 13 years into 2 hours and expect to have all the additional information that came out after. So second volume is required, and I feel that we could further get into the analysis of soil, we can analyze the grounds, we can bring a cadaver dog out there, we can talk to more people who say they were involved, looking for more documentation now that we've laid out the initial tale.
Okay, from the three witnesses, you say roughly 100,000 kids in 13 years, how many of those died?
Oh, they said mostly. This was their words. Mostly.
Okay, now, here's a huge problem. Where are 100,000 kids buried?
That was the question asked in the motion picture. Their answer was a variety. Stuart Swerdlow, who claims he was one of the boys that survived, now grown up, of course, he claims that he remembers seeing bodies covered in lime and that they were either interred or they were cremated in a facility down inside the base. So that's represented in the picture, and they talk about it, because that was one of my main questions. Where did the bodies go? There's got to be a body. And I end this film using an analogy, saying that this whole thing is tantamount to an endless road bordered by a dark forest on both ends. My investigation is that it needed to just stop, because it just seems to keep going nowhere. Every time I keep searching, it's just so difficult to find any particular evidence that I feel like this recent information that I found that might lead to some small evidence, a small paper trail, kind of like MKUltra. There was a paper filed in the wrong place, and that's how that whole thing was discovered in the first place, or it was revealed officially. So I just feel like this might be the same situation. I might be able to get some kind of documentation that activity was happening at Camp Hero when it shouldn't have been, according to public record.
Without revealing sources, obviously, what's the new information that has given you new vigor to pursue something you just said you felt was hopeless?
Well, I was on Coast to Coast AM a few months back, and I was contacted by email by a person who worked for a major chemical company during that period of time, and this person oversaw documents by the CIA, apparently, through this person's supervisor. And I'm not saying whether it's a man or woman. That's why I keep saying this person.
Okay. And we're not naming the chemical company, of course.
I can't. I can't just yet, because I think this person's in jeopardy of losing their pension. But I think that...
If not worse.
Yeah, if not worse.
I mean,
worse.
Come on. This is a crime. This is a federal crime. If he actually can blow the whistle or point you to documents that can substantiate any part of this, somebody is in jeopardy. Maybe a lot of people. So
oh,
there would be
an kidnapped children is revealed. This is a huge crime. I even consider being very cautious myself about what I'm searching. This is no longer, you know, this is not a Hardy Boys mystery. I'm in big trouble if I, you know, find something in this. I'm not saying I will, but, you know, you never know.
I would recommend that one of your guests in your new show, in your new movie, be a prosecutor. You need to get a prosecutor. You need to run all the information by the prosecutor. And then actually I would suggest on camera interacting with the prosecutor to find out from a professional how you go about building a case.
I agree with you, but I don't think I should be the one making the case. I think the victims like James Bruce should be making the case, or anybody else that claims they're a victim, just like Christina Cola and all the other victims of Tuskegee and MKUltra came out in 95. I think they should approach Congress, and that's one of the main questions that I've had. How come, if you are, and this is going out to anybody out there that claims they're a victim of the Montauk Project, if you are a victim, you should do something about it. Even if you can get the government to admit to it slightly, you know, these people who claim they were part of MKUltra were compensated. If you really are a victim, you know, start a case. Contact me. I mean, I think Richard made a great point, but it is not my case. You know, I wasn't a victim of the Montauk Project.
No, but as the filmmaker, I think in terms of strategizing how to get more information, having someone who is actually prosecuted these kinds of cases as a consultant, maybe not on camera, but I would think it would be interesting on camera, because to me, how do you go from something that's inherently so unbelievable? I mean, Justice Frankfurter, the Supreme Court Justice Frankfurter during World War II, is on record as saying he flatly could not believe the rumors of the Nazi concentration camps because it was just too horrible. As long as a secret is protected by it's too horrible, anything can go on. That's been the problem with ETs and UFOs and black ops projects and strange technologies. It's all so unbelievable that that becomes the first line of defense that it couldn't possibly be going on. Once you get past that barrier, you need to arm yourself with legal expertise to how to pursue evidence to make the case, if there's a case there to be made. At least that's my recommendation.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I'm going to encourage anybody. I want to put them on the spot. I'm going to say, listen, if I was a victim of this, I would have already approached Congress. Why haven't you? That's going to be my main question to anybody who claims they were a victim.
And we have other class action suits of individuals, part of a class, who have been discriminated against, including by the government. You brought up Tuskegee. So we know this process, this procedure can work if you get a critical mass of witnesses who insist this is what happened to me.
Correct. And I've already thought of pursuing it, and I'm trying to encourage anybody that I already know of, including James Bruce, that if you're a victim of these things, let's do it. You know.
So how many people do you think have survived that would actually be out there in the night listening to us now to tell the tale?
Well, they said in regard to the numbers, there were very few, but I guess very few in regard to hundreds of thousands could be found.
Could be a lot. Could be a lot, yes. And obviously, the more independent folks that you have corroborating the same story, the better, particularly if we want justice for these people.
Yes. Well, there are a lot more now than there were when I began. There were only a few in the 90s. There's just those four men. And then later on, it was a few more. But that's, I think, maybe one or two in addition. But now there are hundreds of people claiming they were part of it.
By the way, our vast audience has come through. We put it out that we wanted the name of the NBC TV series that sounds like your movie. was called The Pretender.
Oh.
And that comes from Scott in San Diego. And to this audience, Scott is somewhat well-known because he has contributed some interesting things to the conversation over the last several weeks. Okay, we've got about 2 minutes left. Anything you want to leave us with?
Just keep an open mind. You know, take a look at my picture if you're interested in this subject matter. I did throughout the investigation. I'm going to continue. And have a look at it, if you will, at MontaukChronicles.com. And if you have any questions for me, send me an email from the website.
And do you need resources? Are you doing a Kickstarter campaign to fund a new movie? Because movies are not cheap even with the technology. They still are difficult.
I actually am starting a campaign for a different project, not for Ghosts of Montauk. It's for another project I've had in development for 10 years. It's actually called South Texas Blues. And it's a metaphysical fantasy film based on what happened on the set during the summer of 1973, on the set of the making of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh,
what happened during that summer?
You get into the most bizarre things. So something happened?
Sure. It was the intense Texas heat, the lack of money, people being cooped up, sleep deprivation, making this insane horror film.
You're not claiming that someone actually was murdered, are you?
Oh, no, not at
all.
Okay,
okay, just checking.
Just the amazing aspect of what happens on an independent, because this was an independent film set. Nobody on that set knew that that movie was going to become one of the most infamous horror films ever made. So they're on that set. These are all independent people, mostly on a summer job, and the director's just so intense about this film. But he has no idea what's about to happen. He became a very famous Hollywood director after that, but at that time he wasn't. And I think it's an interesting study where someone's making something, they have no idea where it's going to go.
You know,
they,
Chris, know. I think you have a future as a filmmaker. You have a different point
that.
Of view. You have an interesting way of doing your profession. But the things that you are intrigued with, the mysteries beneath the normalcy, it's almost like Swerdlow's existence, his very life.
Sure. Oh, I like the odd end of things. You know, I think the norm sometimes is overpopulated.
On that note, you hear the music in the background. We've come to the end of another show. 2 hours, just like that. Hey, Chris, I really thank you for being my guest this morning. We're going to follow your progress, follow your bliss, make it ours. And until the next show, until the next time we meet, good night and good morning from the other side of midnight.
Thank you so much, Richard.